Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. You may know Jenny Slate from films like Obvious Child, animated shows like Bob's Burgers, or the role for which she still says she is recognized most often, Mona Lisa Saperstein, on Parks and Rec.
Daddy, someone set a fire in your car because you took too long and I got bored. Money, please!
Oh, no, there's no money.
Oh, my bad. No problem.
Oh, okay.
That's fine. I'll just destroy this office.
Oh, hey!
Money, please! Money, please.
Ben, give her some money. It's easier.
Of course, there was a time when Jenny was pretty much only known as that SNL cast member who was fired from the show after accidentally dropping an F-bomb during a live sketch. A narrative that she has always maintained is simplistic and kind of ridiculous. That was 15 years ago, and in the time since, Jenny has proven she is so much more than that one moment. She wrote a book of essays called Little Weirds. She was part of the Oscar-nominated team that made Marcel the Shell with Shoes On. And this week, her utterly unique comedic voice is on brilliant display in an excellent new stand-up special called Seasoned Professional, which premieres this Friday, February 23rd, on Amazon Prime Video. Jenny and I get into so much in this episode, including her big return to stand-up comedy after an extended hiatus, how working on projects like Kroll Show and Marcel the Shell helped her recover from the whole SNL thing, what it was like to pass the torch of her big mouth character Missy to Ayo Edebiri, and more. We begin by talking a little bit about our own shared history that goes back more than 20 years. But before we get into that, here's a clip from the trailer for her new special.
After I had my baby, I was blessed with an instant set of Double D Milky Psycho Naturals. I like negged myself looking at these jugs. I was like, honestly, I don't usually think that funny girls are attractive. But like, you've caught my attention tonight, girl.
Well, Jenny, it is such a pleasure to have you here. And I feel like we have to begin by disclosing something, by acknowledging that we have a little shared history. We were both at Columbia at the same time. And I am currently married to your old improv teammate and varsity show cast member, Ariana.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. I was like, oh, my God. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. But we're both very grown up now.
I know. It's been a while.
Wow. Yeah. You and Ariana got married. That's so cute.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's been 22 years since we got together at Columbia. I mean, that shows how long it's been since you were doing improv and in Fruit Punch and Varsity Show and all of that fun stuff.
Well, I also married Gabe Liedman. So I'm, you know.
It worked out.
My husband and his husband are always kind of like, are you sure? But yeah, Gabe and I in our way have also been together that long. Wow, yeah. That is so cute. Cute.
Yeah. Yeah, that was quite a group that came out of that improv group and the Varsity Show and all of that. I mean, you and Gabe and Kate McKinnon and Greta Gerwig and Grace Parra, and really everyone's kind of gone on to some really great stuff. I mean, do you feel like there was a secret sauce? Was there something about that time and that group that just produced so many talented people?
It's really also, it's funny that like, yeah, you would think there would be more interest in that little enclave, because you know who else was in that group was Brandon Victor Dixon, who became like a Broadway star, and Robbie Mook, who ran Hillary Clinton's campaign. I don't know if you're
that. I didn't know.
That
yeah.
happened in the news, but when she ran for president.
Oh, yeah. I think I remember something about that.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of funny people who were given the gift of a great community. And then tried their hardest to, you know, to keep climbing. But when you look back on it, it's like, wow, wow, it is incredible what that group was. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel like it was formative for you comedically?
Yes. And not just, I mean, everything comedically to me is always linked to the personal and not just like, you know, romantic stuff, but like how I am a learner and how I like am a social person. That was everything to me. I think being in the improv group genuinely helped me with my studies. It was also the first time that like I made best friends that had totally similar interests, and like the best friends were so cool to me, but also just so close and intimate. It was the first time that I just felt powerful, and also that I was like working at my highest ability at the time, but that I also, yeah, it was like around other young creative people that I felt equal to, but also in awe of. And that's just like, that is the most precious thing. Yeah. I loved that time. And it definitely changed my life because it also gave me confidence kind of outside of what I think I assumed you were allowed to be confident about, like goofing around, doing voices, getting attention, playing games. Those were things that often interrupted my, you know, New England private school experience.
You mentioned that's, you know, where you met Gabe Liebman, who became a real comedy partner for you and, you know, has, you've worked with him in lots of different ways over the years. In those sort of early post-college days, I know you were started doing stand-up and doing some stand-up as a team as well. At that point, what did you feel like the goal was? Like, what were you trying to achieve in those very early days when you started doing stand-up?
You know, luckily it was pretty vague. I think it's good that it was vague. Like the vague, weird thing of just like, I want to be an actor in movies. I want to be an actor on TV. I want to be an actor who gets paid to act. It was so general to me that I think now I've really honed, you know, what I want to be as a performer and like where I am. But back then it was like, you know, there were some really, really cool pieces of comedy that existed. Like the big one for me was Strangers with Candy. I just could not deal with how in love with I was with that show, with the writing, with how disgusting it was. With how like tragic and like in a way sort of brutal, but also like weirdly full of heart, and how there was the center of it was a female character, obviously played by Amy Sedaris. She played Jerry Blank, who was like just the grossest, like just so ignorant and like diseased, and but also just, you know, with a huge sex drive and like no or moral abilities at all. And the show was sort of framed as an after school special or like a, you know, a show for high schoolers if anyone hasn't seen it. And like, I just remember seeing that and just being like, holy fucking shit. I have never seen this. I haven't even seen a man be this way, mm-hmm. you know, in terms mm-hmm. of being gross and being horny and just gunning it for sex and being really inappropriate. Like I just... That to me, I was like, I want to be able to floor it. I didn't really know how. I had like a lifetime dream of being on SNL, but I also had a lifetime dream of like just kind of being like Carol Burnett, and not just the Carol Burnett show, but like Carol Burnett in Annie, like really important to me because she was like full on being that character, and it's an incredible performance. But I like also loved performances like I love the Addams Family, like Morticia. I just wanted to like play characters, but also be able to wear beautiful things. But I wanted to also be like repulsive. I wanted to kind of be everything. So it was just.
Well, I feel like gross and horny are good adjectives to describe your new special, Seasoned Professional. I don't know if that's what you were going for, but I really enjoyed the new stand-up special. And you know, you've done stand-up as I said, like you started really early, but you've kind of moved away from it and back to it over the years. So do you feel like this was a time when you just really felt like you were ready to talk about stuff as yourself on stage in this way?
I guess so. Like, I guess it's like, you know how sometimes you hear about like fruit trees. And it's like, they just didn't have any this year, you know, like it's, what do they call it? Like there's like a something year, like a, not like a full year, but it's like a something like that. Like I'm not, I don't really feel like I'm, as a performer, that I'm really in charge of like when it's time. And I'm not like, there's no separation between me living my life and like starting to just come up with perceptions that all of a sudden feel like something I'd like to say on stage. The difference, I think, for me is that, like, first of all, there was the pandemic. Secondly, I was pregnant for the first exact 9 months of the pandemic. Then I had a baby. I didn't have like a system in place for how to get back up on stage. I didn't know how to do that. And, you know, I'm not a touring comedian. Like that's actually never been my thing. I do sometimes go to cities when somebody invites me to go to a theater, but I've never played clubs. And in order for me to be a stand-up comedian, I've always had to believe that I can do it on my own timeline. And that's like, there's not a lot of proof for that, except for that I keep showing up. But every time a little time has gone by, I'm like, I don't know, maybe it's over. And not because I don't feel funny, but either way, what happened was that when my daughter was like a little bit over 1 year old, I came back to Los Angeles and I did like a couple shows at Largo. And I was like, I don't honestly know what I'm going to say here, but I had just a couple of things that were interesting to me. And I've always liked to improvise. And I've always liked to admit that, like, this is open, you know, I'm like trying right now. And luckily audiences have been interested in that. And so I did like maybe a couple shows where I was like, oh, it turns out I actually do want to talk about like what giving birth was like to me. And that it turns out I do want to talk about, you know, these, like, it was like, there were like four things and then they made up these large blocks. And then I took like, and that was like maybe in March. And then I went back to Massachusetts and was just kind of like living quietly. And then honestly, like my agents, like very gently encouraged me to just do some tour dates and like genuinely encouraged me to just do enough so that I knew what it was. And like, you know, they were like, there is a special. And I was like, yeah, I want to do a special, but it was like very vague. And then, I just kind of like slowly, quietly kept building it. I do think there's a big thing to be said for some people that, like, if you're sensitive and easily discouraged, you have to kind of keep your ideas in the dark. And that's sort of my deal. And, but I just kept building, and like, finally the date for the special, like I got the special, which is really nice. Like people from Amazon and A24 saw one of my shows and I was like, it'll be something like this, but I'm still working on it, but it'll be something like this. And like, I'm a seasoned professional. I've already had, you know, one special before. This is how I work. This is how I'm a professional. Like take a chance, let me show up. And they did. And I'm really grateful for it. And I did maybe like, I don't know, I think a total of like six dates at different theaters and festivals, always a theater of like 800 people or so. And then finally I was like, I think it's this. And I worked with, you know, Gillian Robespierre and Elizabeth Holm, who I made this special with, to just like ask them, like, is this flow cool? But I never like wrote anything down or anything.
You say pretty early in the special, you want to, quote, share as much as you can share without going to jail. and it just made me think about how do you think about how much of your personal life to share on stage? I mean, we're talking about all these, you know, really personal things that you talk about in your comedy. And it's obviously very autobiographical as opposed to someone who's doing observations about other people or, you know, things like that. Do you have sort of a line of where you go, you know, I don't want to really reveal this, but I want to talk about this other thing? Or how do you make those decisions?
I think at this point, like, just because my daughter is, you know, a baby, or she's three, but she's still a baby. And like, you can't, I could ask her a question and she could answer like, yes, and just honestly not mean it. Like she has no ability to plan or advocate for herself, really. I mean, she know, you know, if she's like, I want tights, not pants, it's like, this is real, we need to get her some tights. But you know, but I can't be like, Ida, are you okay if I tell the story about how, you know, like that is not going to be a lasting bit of consent. So I think about that. And I also hope that, like, eventually, if she's, you know, like old enough that I feel like we're both kind of on even thing about what's okay to share, that if there's something I want to talk about because I think it's funny, and she says, okay, that I'll do it. But I'm not like, you don't need to use everything in order to tell the truth. Like I'm also not really like, there's nothing I'm leaving out, but I generally don't want to hurt anyone's feelings just because that hurts me in the end. I don't want to hurt myself more than I already feel uncomfortable. And so, yeah. But if I talk about my husband, I always ask. And I will say there's like, I've definitely cleared it with my therapist about talking about her. But in anticipation of my special coming out, I've realized like maybe my mom might be hurt by a joke I made about realizing that my special isn't that my therapist isn't actually my mom.
Yeah, yeah.
And I
could see that.
Yeah, because honestly, I'm just like, I don't know if my mom's going to get this joke. Like, I think she might just be hurt by it. She's not like a big comedy person, which is hilarious because I've made this my life. But like, you know, I don't know. I'm worried about it.
Have you had that experience of doing something in comedy, whether stand-up or anything else, that you realized had hurt someone's feelings or was received in a different way than you intended?
No, I actually really haven't yet. So I really don't want to have that experience. I'm not looking for it. And I, you know, while I would love to like, you know, put some wind in everyone's sails, I'm not really into ruffling feathers. And it's not that I'm like a suck up who just like can't say how she feels. It's just that like, I genuinely believe there's probably a way to talk about what's going on for me without stepping on anyone's face, you know?
I mean, one of the bits in the special that stood out to me was the whole thing about, you know, being afraid to ride a bike. Which felt very real.
So I took an airplane to Amsterdam. He came to the airport with flowers, which obviously made me have an orgasm right away. And he's like, da da da, and we'll do this and that, and then we'll get on the bikes. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. So sorry. I feel like I heard like a weird word. He's like, we'll get on the bikes. And I was like, oh, there's the other fucking shoe. I'm looking at this guy. I'm like, I thought you were fucking perfect. And now you just said the most fucked up thing that anyone has ever said to me. Get on the bikes? How dare you? Like, the idea that you would just be so, you would just assume that someone would do sports with you in another country. Like, I was fucking freaked out. Like, I was like, oh, I should get on another plane and go home. Like, this is so, and I was just like standing there like, I'm not an adrenaline junkie, you know, I don't want to fucking ride a bike, but like, I was just like, I want to be brave for love.
I immediately thought of your second appearance on Girls, which, because we actually just finished rewatching that entire series, which I highly recommend. It really holds up. And it's there's that great scene where you have to ride bikes with Lena Dunham's character. And that whole thing was so great because it was just these great sort of, you had these great bookend scenes in that show where you appear very early on and then and towards the end. Yeah, what do you remember about that experience and sort of how it relates to your fear of bikes?
I remember being really excited about the way that the character had expanded. I was like really glad to come back to the show. I was really excited about the storyline. There was a great monologue at the end. You know, the whole thing was kind of an actor's dream. And I remember being like, oh my God, I'm fucked. I'm so scared of riding bikes. I mean, yeah, that's acting. That is acting right there. I was like really scared on the bikes. And yeah, I just,
but you have to act like you're just like a carefree spirit who loves riding bikes.
Totally. And who like owns a bike and has one, you know, just, like that was deeply, not just unfamiliar to me, but I was like, I'm not sure that these people know that I might like bike into traffic. Like we were just biking through Manhattan and it, it was real. And I was very frightened, but they did their best to make me feel safe. And I did my best to not tell them how scared I was because there's a certain level of embarrassment that I can handle. And then a certain level that I'm like, I'm embarrassed that the people know how embarrassed I am, but we still all have to go through it. So I think I balanced it perfectly, but yeah, you know, like I really hope I never have to ride a bike again.
That the monologue you mentioned is so great too in that episode, and it felt to me watching it again like Lena was kind of writing about her own fame and isolation and some of those issues through your character, because it's happening in the show to your character's kind of achieve this thing that she hasn't, but obviously in real life she had by that point. It was the last season of Girls. Did you think about that at all while you were, you know, making that?
To be honest, I didn't. I was just so hungry for the acting. And also, you know, sometimes it serves to be like, where did this come from? But like, sometimes it does not. And I think I've got a pretty good, like, curiosity slash sensitivity around that area. And like, no, I it's weird. I mean, I can totally understand what you're saying. And maybe that's where she was at. But, you know, first of all, like, Lena's a really enjoyable person to be around. She's really fun. And just is a really good, enchanting personality. And so I think mostly I was just like, yay, I'm so excited to be back here. I was very flattered to be invited back. Like the initial invitation is always great. But the second, you know, like being asked back to anything is like, that means, you know, you did a good job in the first part. So that was really good. So no, I don't think I was. I was just so excited to have that sort of tragic but really real monologue. And that's really funny and very specific. You don't often get handed a piece of writing like that. So I was just excited.
Do you know I Google myself every day? It's so gross, but I do. And I just want to see if like Gawker or whoever they are has written some snarky thing about how much of a hack I am. Or if even there's just like a pretty picture of me in the Financial Times roundup of books of the year. I need to see how other people see me, because it's the only way that I can see myself. I wake up every morning and I think, well, okay, what would Tally Schifrin do? Tally Schifrin is not even me now. She's just like this thing that I've created. She's a monster that I've made and I have to feed. And she feeds on praise and controversy. And it's exhausting and boring at once.
You know, you mentioned that one of those early dreams was SNL, and I know you've had to talk about this a lot over the years.
Yeah.
And is not maybe your favorite topic. But it did occur to me just sort of looking at your, you know, resume and everything, that it's now been 15 years since that time, which is kind of crazy to think about. And I'm curious if you're sort of able to separate the excitement and sort of the fact that you are part of that history with maybe the more negative aspects of how it turned out. Like, are you able to appreciate that is, you know, part of your career and part of your life, or does it sort of only have negative feelings now?
Oh, I would never choose to separate it. I think it's so fucking cool that I sort of like touched that dream. I'm proud of myself, and I don't want to separate it anymore. I don't know that I ever did. I just, you know, I'm a good student. I like to do a good job. I'm a former speech team kid. I like to win. And being a performer is at the center of my identity, and is like, you know, that's like within the structure of my like heart. So you can't remove anything if you want to keep what you received. I just don't. I think that would be so unwise. And it's just also not how I work. So yeah, no, I'm able to, it's almost magical, like in this weird way to think about it. And there's a lot of weird rewards that come from situations that like, I think we might think are more shadowy. There's just so many rewards. I don't go towards the shadow, you know, like I'm not like one of those people that's like, let's try to make it intense so that like we can all grow, you know, but I'm also not so foolish at this point that I'm like, only the good things give you the good things.
What were those rewards? I mean, what are you thinking about when you say that?
Being in charge of the, like being the estimator of my own self-confidence, having to like double down on my commitment to how like how romantic and also really alive it feels to me to be within my own identity as an artist, a belief in the long game, you know, a belief in like in many, many options. I think it's always important to believe in like primacy, like in to believe in like something plural rather than like primacy, you know, like it's really important to believe that there's like actually 20 really cool, weird secret doors rather than like one big golden ornate legendary door. Like that doesn't make any sense for any artist that has actually ever existed. You know, there's like just a lot of little places to scurry in and then find like a bigger space for yourself. And just like the process of rejuvenation and having to be in charge of that, like community is real. Everyone needs it. And like, I've leaned on my community so hard throughout my career, but like genuinely when it comes down to it, even if you're an actor and you need those like casting directors to give you your jobs and stuff, like when you get to set or when you get on stage as a stand-up and you have the microphone, like, or I mean, not to be whatever, but like, if you're the person who has the baby in your birth canal, like you're the only one that's going to have to get that baby out of your vagina. Like the doctor can pull it out, but like, it's you, like at the center of life, at the center of your action, at the center of your perception, it's you. And like, there are a lot of things from the outside world or culture that may try to convince us that it is others. And like others need to be there. I'm not a loner. I love being around other people and I am intensely lonely almost immediately when alone. But like, if I hadn't had that experience at the start of my career, I wouldn't have understood how much is like really up to me.
Coming up, Jenny opens up about how she was able to move on from SNL and find creative fulfillment on another sketch show that felt a lot more like her.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to our episodes with some of Jenny Slate's many collaborators, including Big Mouth creator Nick Kroll, Parks and Rec's Ben Schwartz, and more, along with everything else from our free archive. And you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Wednesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple and Spotify to let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Jenny Slate. Well, there's certainly so many examples of people who, you know, didn't work out on that show for whatever reason, but have gone on to do incredible things. And I think you're certainly one of them. You know, I think about your work on Kroll Show, speaking of Nick Kroll, as such, I love that show so much. And I thought you did so much great stuff on it. And it's a very different kind of sketch show. Was there something about that experience that felt really different to you in terms of, because it's a similar, it's a sketch show in the same way, but it's very different. You know, how was it different for you?
I mean, it was different because it was different people, a different work culture. And because like, I'll always thrive in an environment of like newness, you know, like that's what my stand-up is about too. It's about immediacy. Like Nick had this idea to use the format of the reality show, which at the time was like kind of a new type of programming. It wasn't a given that it is now. And all of the characters were new and all of the people who worked on the show were were eager and unafraid and equal, and there wasn't a system in place, and there wasn't anything to rise to. There was only like a show to arrive at, you know, just like arriving to an improv group. It was,
I'm sure the stakes must have been felt pretty high for Nick because it was his show and his name was on it. But overall, it seems like maybe it's lower stakes and that it's a smaller show kind of launching, you know, without the attention that when you're the new cast member on SNL that brings.
I mean, different stakes, but the stakes felt high for me because, you know, coming up at Rafifi in that stand-up venue, Nick was just always one of the best, you know, like he just was like the funniest, but it's not just that he was so funny. It was that like off stage, you know, everyone knew him as like a nice person who was like really fun to hang out with. And I really, you know, to get his seal of approval, to be invited there, I wanted to do my best. And I was kind of like, you know, limping along emotionally, just like kind of embarrassed. Of course I was embarrassed and heartbroken at the time. But that's because I also had a really limited view of where one could be a character actor and sketch performer and also do like really, really good, like turbo cutting edge comedy. And it turned out that like, so those stakes actually felt very high for me. They were personal and they were creative. And then to be there and to be guided, written for, but then also allowed to improvise and just like really do all of the things that I had learned in my improv group at Columbia, you know, like it felt like, oh, this is where I'm supposed to be. And this is a step up for me because I'm growing and I like myself. And like, I like to, you know, it's really important for me to be able to like look around my work environment and my home environment and be like, I like myself and I like how this is going for me. And like, it's good. I'm the one that says I like myself and I do.
Oh, hey guys, I didn't even recognize me.
Like, are you like hiding from like a paparazzi or like?
I may as well soon be considering
like what?
Bangs, I got bangs.
Congrats.
I'm Liz. I had a baby, and now it's time for me to grow up.
And I'm Liz. I got bangs.
Our PR firm is called Publicity.
It's based off our names.
The other thing that came out of that post-SNL time is obviously Marcel the Shell, which, you know, I was just thrilling to see. I'm just was sort of thinking back to seeing it for the first time and, you know, knowing you a little bit and just seeing it take off. Obviously, you couldn't have known at that point that it would become an Oscar-nominated film.
No.
But what do you remember about the experience of realizing that it was becoming a thing and that it was, you know, being seen by millions of people in a kind of unlikely way, which, you know, I'm not even sure if that was the goal for it to go viral.
No,
you know?
Not at all. I don't know. I mean, Dean Fleischer-Camp, who, you know, I made Marcel with, he directed it and I wrote it together and he created the actual like character design of Marcel. I don't know, maybe he had more of an understanding of like the internet, but like both of us are pretty like in the moment type of people in terms of creating things. But we also really want to work, you know, like he always wanted to like be a director and I always wanted to be an actor. And like when we met, we were just kind of out of college basically and like trying to do that. But no, we didn't have any idea. He put it on the internet because somebody who had been at that small show in Brooklyn where he had played it, where he'd shown it, said like that their relative had an injury and they were like in the hospital and the person said like maybe this would cheer them up.
So, wow.
So he like made a Vimeo of it.
Vimeo, yeah.
Yeah.
And so that, yeah, it was intended maybe for one person to see and then like tens of millions later.
Yeah. I think when it's like intended for one person to enjoy, but you don't know that person well, so that person could kind of be anyone, but you just have like goodwill towards them and you're like, I don't know, take what you want. That's a really, actually, maybe that's a really good way to connect to as many people as possible, is like to see the specificity of the sweetness of the stranger, of their humanity, and like create your own art specifically, but like not really have a deal in place.
Guess what I wear as a hat?
What?
A lentil. One time I nibbled on a piece of cheese and my cholesterol went up to 900. Guess what I used to tie my skis to my car?
What?
A hair. Guess what my skis are?
What?
Toenails from a man. Do you want to see me talk on the phone?
Sure.
Hello, this is me.
The use of your voice was obviously the thing that stood out in that. And I imagine that helped lead to all of this, you know, incredible animation work that you've done since then. Did it feel like there was a line between Marcel and a lot of the voiceover work you've been able to do?
It's kind of hard for me to tell, actually. It's like up until, I mean, now that we made the feature and we got such lovely rewards through it for it, like, you know, in terms of like recognition or like that kind of like awards stuff. I think oh, maybe people know that I did that, but it's always felt like a little bit hard to attach the external Marcel stuff to me as a performer. Like I know I play Marcel and he's with me all the time. And I do the voice a lot for my daughter. And she thinks he's like, I don't know what she thinks, that he lives in my mind. I'm not sure. But like, I actually feel that my voice work started in kind of like a parallel, randomly just parallel journey, which was that like, while I was on SNL, maybe I took like a general meeting at Universal, I believe. I just like met with an executive there. And then before I made Marcel, they offered me my very first voiceover role, which was to play the mom in The Lorax. And that was with Illumination. And then Illumination just started hiring me. And I don't know how much they knew about Marcel. I think that the director of The Secret Life of Pets was a Marcel fan. I'm pretty sure about that. But it kind of felt like I just did this one job and I really liked it. And then I was just so lucky that they kept hiring me. And I'm not sure how I was able to like score this much of like great work in animation, because like being on Bob's Burgers, being on The Great North, those people are not only so good at writing and so funny, but they're like angels. They're so nice. I love it. I love recording The Great North. I laugh so hard. And when I record Bob's Burgers, I actually just like, I'm just such a fan of the show. It's almost like confusing to me every time I'm there.
I love your character on that show. It's really great.
I love it too.
Yeah. Obviously Big Mouth as well. I thought you were so great on that show. It is kind of wild that, you know, you obviously decided to step back from the role of Missy and pass it on to Ayo Edebiri before she blew up. And it's kind of been amazing to see her career, you know, take off in these last couple of years. I thought the way that you guys handled that was really artful in the way the sort of passing of the torch of the character.
Ralph texted me again.
I told you men are trash.
Oh, wow, that's a rather aggressive qualifier, but I do agree that men are garbage.
You know what? Niggas ain't shit.
Whoa, okay, oh boy. N-word alert.
Girl, N-word?
Man, that's some shit our mom taught her.
Yeah, she says you're never supposed to say that word.
She can't say it because she's of the Caucasian persuasion. But you can.
Oh, no. I don't. I definitely cannot.
Yes, you can.
I promise you, it is not okay for me to say that word.
So I was just curious, what were the conversations around, you know, doing that? You know, not the decision to do it, which I think you've talked about and people understand, but sort of how to do it and do it in a way that worked so well on the show.
I actually wasn't a part of those conversations at all. Like the producers of Big Mouth, like let me know that Aya was going to do it. And so I just like wrote her an email at that time, just like, just to say like, hi. And, you know, like, But that was kind of it. And then she and I just became friends sort of outside of it all, which has been a deep delight. She is truly
she's incredible.
Yeah, she really is. And she's like exactly what she seems to be. She is like just really phenomenal through and through.
This year is also the 10th anniversary of Obvious Child, which is pretty crazy. It was just, I know it was at Sundance 10 years ago this past January. You know, that's another one where I feel like Did you feel like at that time that that was a chance to show a really different side of you? I mean, to obviously to be the lead in a film, a very funny film, but that has some, you know, some drama to it as well. So what was, you know, 10 years later, how do you think about that one?
I think of that as like the greatest gift I've received as a performer, that Gillian thought of me for that part. I had never really been in anything like dramatic, and I had this feeling about myself that I could do it. But how do you know you can do something until you do it? You know, I'm not one of those performers that's like, maybe I will get in trouble for this, but like, that's like offer only. Like, I'm like, I want to go, like, let me get in there and show you that I can do it. Otherwise, I'm not going to be sure that I can do it. I need to know that I can do it.
Yeah. If you got an offer for something way outside of your wheelhouse, it might make you a little nervous.
Yeah. I mean, I would do it. I think I would do it, but I'm not saying that I wouldn't, but I guess I really like the opportunity to show that I can. I just need a lot of like evidence from myself. But sometimes that just comes with, you know, if I'm lucky enough to like get offered something, doing the scenes in my home and like making sure I can touch that emotional space. And if I can, then it's like, cool. But for Obvious Child, they did just like bring it to me. And I remember calling my dad about like 3/4 through the shoot and being like, I'm doing something here that I've never done before. And I'm not stumbling through it. I am like fully here. I am fully operational. I'm in control, but I'm also innovating, like in terms of like my own understanding of myself as a performer. Like I'm creating some innovations inside. And I just was saying to him, like, this is the start of something new for me. And that has nothing to do with like, you know, recognition, like whether or not I would get recognition for the role, but it was like, I'm somewhere I've never been, and I'm going to be able to come back to this creative space, whether or not it's in acting or maybe it'll be in writing, but like, I've just never played these keys before, emotionally speaking. And I can, I'm totally here. It's me. I can do it. And, it just opened so much up for me as a performer. It was such a positive experience. It was a dream. I loved every second of it. I loved going to Sundance with everyone from Obvious Child. Gillian and Liz are two of my best friends still. I've worked with them many times over now. And like, we've done a lot of things together. And, you know, they've done both of my comedy specials.
Yeah. So it was really a relationship that has paid dividends over time.
Yeah. It's really, really, really important to me.
Can't believe you walked into the store. That's a sign.
And that would be a sign saying,
like, that I'm a present in a box and that he and I should go and start our beautiful life together.
You know, I'm not a straight guy.
Oh, what?
But my guess is that most of them would hate that gift.
What? You're saying that a guy doesn't want a drunk pregnant girl in a box?
If you're a serial killer.
Maybe you want to tell him.
No, why? Why? You don't owe him anything. You don't even know this guy.
Maybe he just deserves to know that, like, this happened, that I'm not a psycho, and I'm going to get an abortion.
You know, if I got someone pregnant, I would want to know.
If you got someone pregnant, I would also want to know.
Probably every newspaper would want to know, because all of a sudden some dude's mouth would be pregnant.
Oh my God! Oh my God.
Yeah, revisiting it did make me wonder whether it would be harder to make a comedy that's so centered on abortion 10 years later, which is not where we would have hoped we would be 10 years later.
I know, it's so weird because it's like, in a way, abortion doesn't feel like as much of a taboo thing to speak about as it did then, but it is actually like a healthcare situation and is like a medical procedure that is so strongly, you know, like so strongly prohibited and so strongly blocked. And like, you know, so many people are getting in the way of reproductive justice in the way that like, it just seemed, you know, this was like a before Roe was overturned.
Yeah. I mean, in the movie, it's a given. The choice that she has is a given in a way it wouldn't be in a lot of the country now.
Yeah. Yeah. There's just like kind of different things to talk about in regards to reproductive justice right now. I think it wouldn't. Yeah. I think we made that movie at the right moment for that movie to be made. And I'm really, really glad we did.
Yeah. You know, you said you found a new mode of working in that. Have you been able to get back in that mode as much as you would like to over the years? Or are there things, you know, projects or things that you would want to do more in that vein that you haven't been able to do?
I feel like when we made our second film that Gillian and Liz wrote called Landline, which is a really great movie, that was a time for me to like get into that zone again. But it was a really difficult time for me personally. So it felt like the work was like my lifeboat, my life raft, but everything else was a really stormy sea. Whereas like when I made Obvious Child, I felt just like really stable in my life. And it was a really good time on and off set. And so it's kind of sad because when we made Landline, I was gripping onto the work, and I did the work that I wanted to do. And I'm very proud of that performance. And I kind of wish more people had seen that movie. I feel like,
yeah, it flew a little under the radar.
Yeah. We didn't get the, like, I don't know. We just like, we didn't get that kind of like, what do you call it? Like just like the money for a campaign that, you know, the way that A24 gave us so much when Obvious Child came out, like, you know, we had ads in the subway and it was cool. And it wasn't the same for, I don't know why, but for Landline, I love that movie and I loved our cast so much. But I think I'm about to enter some work that will really help me return to like the width of like how wide I can go in my emotions. I'm really excited for my next job, which I'm doing, which is called Dying for Sex. And I'm about to start it at the beginning of March. And I'm really, really, really excited by everyone I'm working with. And the scripts are really good and performers are outrageously good. But I also feel that like my, you know, writing my book, Little Weirds, that gets me into that zone in a different way. And
it doesn't have to be on screen in a character.
It's just kind of like one of the things I love about George Saunders is that he has spoken about and written in his book, A Swim in a Pond. Is it A Swim in the Pond in the Rain or A Swim in a Pond in the Rain? A Swim in a Pond in the Rain. I'm always messing it up, but either way, he talks about like that the creative energy is, and I'm paraphrasing here and probably butchering it, but like, it's going to go somewhere, you know, like I try to be really focused on that like, yeah, maybe my like dramatic energy, my feeling of like wanting to touch something that feels like shadowy or explosive or prickly or just sort of like teary or bitter, whatever, that doesn't have to go into like a really, really great part on screen, but it can go into writing. It can go into stand up. It's just like, how can you, how do you make it appropriate? I'm really interested in finding more and more of those zones.
Well, with the little bit of time we have left, I want to do our final segment, which is called The First Laugh. So I'm going to run through some of these questions with you, starting with the first piece of comedy that made you laugh really hard as a kid growing up. What comes to mind?
I guess Pee-wee.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And yeah, like, especially like the like, what's your big butt, Simone? Like Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Yeah, but Pee-wee, yeah.
Do you remember the first time that you knew that you were funny, that you could make other people laugh?
I remember there being like a, like skits at camp, you know, where there would be like a pillowcase filled with objects. You had to like pick out a hairbrush and like do a skit. And I remember like feeling like athletic almost, like being like, oh, I have a thing. I have a thing.
Once you started doing stand-up, do you remember the first joke that you wrote that really worked, that connected with an audience, that you felt like, oh, I might have something here?
I never really wrote a joke.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah. Then that question's hard.
Oh, yeah, let's wait. Yeah, but I it was always stories. But I definitely remember, like, you know, just talking about my parents. That was like the first thing that made people laugh, and it made me laugh, and it was totally true. Just like literally talking about my parents' pajamas.
Do you remember the first time that you felt like a famous person, like you were recognized or something that sort of made you realize, oh, this something might be going on here?
I guess maybe like when you exit SNL after the live show and you go outside to go to the party, there's like often fans there of the show. And I remember like leaving and, you know, like just not thinking anybody would want me to sign anything, but like that people like asked me to, you know, for pictures and stuff. And I remember being like, oh, wow, I'm like on the show.
Yeah. It's like that made it feel more real than like actually being on the show.
Well, in a different, like, I mean, when I'm performing, like, I'm not like really thinking about, you know, my like sort of my what how it's registering in the outside world in that way of like, oh, there's Jenny. But like if somebody asks you to like sign a picture of yourself,
yeah, that's pretty,
you know,
spot
you're not
on.
Like getting your license or whatever. And you're like, whoa, that's new. Yeah, you know, that's crazy.
Do you have a story or memory about the first time you met one of your really big comedy heroes?
Let's see. Yeah. I met Amy Sedaris when I was in college. She was at the, like, I think it was at the, like, the Two Boots Pizza, which was in the East Village at the time. And I just freaked out so much. And I was like, ugh! And Amy Sedaris has been so kind to me over the years. Like, she blurbed my book. I have been afraid to interact with her because I love her so much and like, only ever heard good things about her. I just like, it's sort of like, I don't know, like, what if I die? Like, what if I just like have a heart attack because I love her so much. But anyway, I was like, would you sign this napkin for my friend Gabe? And would you mind signing it like as yourself? And also as like Jerry Blank, which now realize is an awkward thing. Like when people ask sign things as like
really on the spot,
I'm like, I don't really know. Like I didn't write that character. But I guess she did write Jerry Blank, but anyway, she did an autograph on one side. And then on the other side, she wrote "Pee on me, Gabe, Jerry Blank."
Did Gabe enjoy that?
It's framed. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Finally, do you have a story or memory from your career that makes you laugh now, but really was not funny when it happened?
I mean, yeah, you know, in my special, it's in my special. It is that I got, I was given the option to audition for the role of Pennywise.
Yes.
Movie It.
It was not funny at the time.
At the time I was like, huh? But then I looked back in my emails to be like, but how did I, you know, cause it definitely hurt my feelings. But one of the things that I think is so telling about me at that point is that I know that I was offended. I know I was like freaked out. Like, oh my God, why would someone send this to me? But I look back in my email and like, you first see me be like, wait, is this clown a girl now? And then like I'm not an outright no. And then I'm like, I don't know. Let me take a look at it. Like, you know, because there's a chance it could be different, right? I'm like, take a look at it. Like what, you know, maybe I could go in on Friday. I'm like sort of edging towards, right? And then you seem, and then there's and like the emails back are just neutral, like totally fine emails that are not, you know, no bad emails on the other side from the reps. They're all just like, you know, take a look, whatever. No, nothing. Nobody's like trying to make me do this. The initial suggestion is absolutely odd, but, and then I'm like, oh, guys, you know, I read this over the weekend and like, I can't. But and the weirdest thing is that I'm not like, why is this happening? But that I'm like, I sort of end the email being like, I'd really like to be in a scary movie, but like, this is definitely not that. XOXO. And it's just like, Jenny, speak up for yourself. Like that one is really on me. There's a lot of times that I'm like, someone did something weird, you know, like there, I've talked about this before, but like there was a guy who showed up to a blind date in a full suit of armor. I went on a date with a guy that wore a full suit of armor and it was horrible. It was like deeply heartbreaking and like sucked. But, and then I like talked about it a lot and was like, this fucking sucked. And it was crazy. It was like genuinely crazy. And it's a crazy story. And it was really, really funny, but at the time horrible, but I like weirdly pushed through. And the thing that joins those two stories for me looking back is that I'm like, I did not set a limit. I didn't leave that date. I didn't speak up at the time when this, you know, I wasn't like, don't ever send anything like, I mean, I guess I wouldn't say don't ever send anything like this, but I just would be like, there's a greater discussion there about like, why is this here? And it's really weirdly been this like odd thing that genuinely, I feel like I should look into like my like astrological schematic right now or whatever. I'm like, I'm learning a lesson right now about speaking up and it's coming to me in a really funny way, but like,
yeah, you're getting a lot of funny messages.
Yeah. And it's like, it's not enough just to feel your own feelings of like, of just like repulsion or of like, this is a bad fit or this doesn't work for me. Like you can feel that on your own side. Like I get that now about myself. I know what I don't like, but I've really learned a valuable lesson about like, probably next time, say it right then.
Yeah. Don't entertain the idea of playing Pennywise for several more emails.
Yeah, don't do it. Don't stay for a fucking full plate of ziti with a guy in a suit of armor if you want to leave. Just fucking leave. Ooh.
Jenny, it's been really, really fun getting to talk with you today. And yeah, as I said, I love your special. And yeah, this was really fun.
Thanks. And, you know, not to be a creep, but say hello to your wife for me.
I will. Well, that was a very special one for me, and I hope you enjoyed it as well. So thanks again to Jenny Slate for taking the time to be my guest on today's show. Her new stand-up special, Seasoned Professional, will be available to stream on Amazon Prime Video starting this Friday, February 23rd. I hope you seek it out. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple and Spotify. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Threads at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram and Threads, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes and see who is coming up next on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.